Communications and Documentation. Introduction. Communication is the transmission of information to another person, whether it is verbal or nonverbal, through body language. Effective communication is an essential component of pre-hospital care and is necessary to achieve a positive relationship with patients and coworkers. Verbal communication skills are vitally important for EMTs. Your verbal skills will enable you to gather information from the patient and bystanders. These skills will also make it possible for you to effectively coordinate with the variety of responders who are often present at the scene. Excellent verbal communication is also an integral part of transferring the patient's care to the nurses and physicians at the hospital. Documentation is the written or electronically recorded portion of your patient care interaction that becomes part of the patient's permanent medical record. It serves many purposes, including demonstrating that the care delivered was appropriate and within the scope and practice of the providers involved. Documentation also provides an opportunity to communicate the patient's story to others who may participate in the patient's care in the future. Adequate reporting and accurate records ensure the continuity of patient care. Complete patient records also guarantee proper transfer of responsibility, comply with the requirements of health departments and law enforcement agencies, and fulfill your organization's administrative needs. Reporting and record-keeping duties are an essential aspect of patient care, although they are performed only after the patient's condition has been stabilized. Documentation in the field drives both funding and research for EMS. Seatbelts are a prime example. Studies gathered from record-keeping in the early 1970s showed that patients have a significantly higher survival rate if seatbelts are used during motor vehicle crashes. Armed with this information, laws were passed to enforce seatbelt usage, and huge amounts of money were spent on educating the public. Radio and telephone communications link you and your team with other members of the EMS, fire, and law enforcement communities. This link helps the entire team to work together more effectively and provides an important layer of safety and protection for each member of the team. You must know what your system can and cannot do, and you must be able to use your system efficiently and effectively. This chapter describes the factors and strategies that you need to be an effective communicator, discusses a variety of effective methods of verbal communication, and provides guidelines for appropriate written documentation of patient care. The chapter concludes by identifying the kinds of communication equipment that are used, along with standard radio operating procedures and protocols. The roles of the Federal Communications Commission in EMS are also described. Therapeutic communication. How do we communicate? This simple question can be surprisingly complex, as there are a number of things to consider during communication. Therapeutic communication uses various communication techniques and strategies, both verbal and nonverbal, to encourage patients to express how they are feeling and to achieve a positive relationship with the patient. This section will discuss the factors and strategies that are necessary for therapeutic communication. People communicate in a variety of ways, such as through eye contact, body position, and facial expressions. Factors such as culture and age need to be taken into consideration during communication. Patients with special needs may require you to consider alternative forms of communication. For example, if your patient is deaf and you cannot communicate using sign language, you may need to communicate by having the patient write down his feelings. Age, culture, and personal experience. The thoughts of people are greatly influenced by their personal experiences. For example, an older person who often experiences significant pain may view pain as more of an inconvenience than a problem. A child who has limited experience with pain would likely react much differently. People from various cultures are taught to handle illness, injury, and pain differently. Some cultures encourage people to express their emotions. Others see it as a sign of weakness. These social and personal pressures will shape how people communicate. Patients may talk, make gestures, or write a note to express how they are feeling. I am so sorry to bother you, but my chest hurts a little. Hey, what took you so long? My chest is killing me. Are you going to help me or what? Both of these messages talk about pain, but they also have much more information within them. The tone, pace, and volume of the language will tell you about the mood of the person communicating. These clues also provide some insight into the perceived importance of the message. For example, the patient who is yelling at you may be angry, scared, or both. Take note not only of the words being spoken, but how they are said. You need to recognize that these concepts of body language and eye contact are often greatly affected by culture. In some cultures, direct eye contact is viewed as impolite, while in other cultures, it is impolite to look away while speaking. For example, in the United States and most European countries, direct eye contact conveys honesty and respect. Conversely, in Latin American, Asian, and African cultures, direct eye contact conveys confrontation. People tend to translate the messages they receive using their own worldview. Ethnocentrism occurs when you consider your own cultural values as more important when you are interacting with people of a different culture. If you are North American, for example, you might think that a patient is hiding something, afraid, or untrustworthy if the patient looks away from you while you are talking. These conclusions may be true if the two people communicating are from the same culture. All aspects of communication, eye contact, social distances, body language, and even touching, have a cultural foundation. In Thailand, for example, the touching of the head is reserved for those who are very intimate. This cultural belief can present a problem for you if the patient's head is bleeding. Cultural imposition takes this idea to an extreme. Some healthcare providers may consciously or subconsciously force their cultural values onto their patient because they believe their values are better. For example, consider a child who is brought to the emergency department, ED, with red marks on his back from a traditional Asian healing practice called coining, rubbing hot coins on the child's back as a treatment for medical illness. The parents explain to the physician that the coining helped for a short time, but now the child seems to be getting sicker. The physician responds angrily to the parents, accusing them of potential abuse and insisting that their practices are harmful, although they are not. This accusation reflects cultural imposition. Nonverbal communication. Facial expressions, body language, and eye contact. Eye contact and body language are powerful communication tools. Consider how dogs interact. When two dogs meet for the first time, they look at each other. The position of the head, shoulders, tail, and back all help to communicate to the other dog. Before they get any closer, the dogs need to understand their new relationship. Who is dominant? Will you hurt me? These questions must be answered quickly. People communicate using a similar technique. The body language we consciously or subconsciously choose provides more information than words alone. Without any words, the mood of every person should be clear. Patients can become hostile toward EMS providers. When you are treating a potentially hostile patient, it is important that you understand and be aware of your own body language. People tend to react to anger with anger. If you are dealing with an angry patient, you must stay calm and try to diffuse the situation before it escalates. Consider the following steps. 1. Assess the safety of the scene. Decide whether you need to call law enforcement. Make sure that you have sufficient backup to ensure the safety of the patient and your crew. 2. Do not assume an aggressive posture. Be aware that if you cross your arms, clench your fists, or place your hands on your hips, it sends a message, whether intentional or not, that you are impatient, uninterested, or asserting a position of authority. Instead, stand with your palms facing out. This communicates openness and acceptance and allows for quick movement, if necessary. 3. Make good eye contact, but do not stare. 4. Speak calmly, confidently, and slowly. With your backup clearly visible, advise the patient what needs to be done or provide the patient with limited, acceptable choices. Sir, I need you to sit on the ambulance cot now. Either you will sit on the cot or we will help you to the cot. 5. Never threaten the patient, either verbally or physically. Personal safety should be your primary concern when caring for any patient, but this is especially true with patients who display hostile behavior. Remember, it is important for you to be attentive to facial expressions, body language, and eye contact, your own and your patient's. These physical cues will help you and your patient to truly understand the message being sent. Additional techniques you can use to calm a patient and establish a therapeutic rapport will be discussed later in this chapter. Physical factors. Various physical factors affect communication, which are referred to as noise. Noise is anything that dampens or obscures the true meaning of the message. Literal noise or sounds in the environment can make it difficult to understand the patient or for the patient to understand you. Lighting, distance, or physical obstacles are other factors that may affect your communication. Cultural norms often dictate the amount of space or proximity between people when communicating. The degree to which people feel comfortable depends on with whom they are communicating. As a person gets closer, a greater sense of trust must be established. When you finally enter someone's intimate space, there must be a high sense of trust. Understanding how communication works and the importance of effective communication is important when gathering information from the patient. Your communication skills will be put to the test when you communicate with patients and/or families in emergency situations. Remember that someone who is sick or injured is scared and might not understand what you are doing or saying. Therefore, your gestures, body movements, and attitude toward the patient are critically important in gaining the trust of both patient and family. Verbal communication. As an EMT, you must master many communication skills, including those associated with radio operations and written communications. Skilled verbal communication with the patient and family, bystanders, and the rest of the healthcare team are an essential part of high-quality patient care and transport. You must be able to listen effectively to fully understand the nature of the scene and the patient's problem. You must also be able to organize your thoughts to quickly and accurately verbalize instructions to the patient, bystanders, and other healthcare professionals. One of the most fundamental aspects of what EMTs do is to ask patients questions. There are two types of questions. Open-ended questions are ones in which a patient needs to provide some level of detail to give an answer, whereas closed-ended questions can be answered in very short or single-word responses. When first approaching your patient, you should use open-ended questions. "Good day, my name is Chuck, and I am an EMT. What seems to be bothering you today?" Open-ended questions allow a free flow of conversation. They let the patient direct you to what is bothering him or her. Closed-ended questions are important to use when patients are unable to provide long or complete answers to questions. Perhaps the patient is having severe breathing problems, or maybe the patient is a child who is scared and doesn't know what to say. In situations for which thoughtful answers are not possible, closed-ended questions are appropriate and are particularly useful when assessing a patient's condition. Are you having trouble breathing? Do you take medications for your heart? With closed-ended questions, however, it is possible for you to miss important issues if pertinent questions are not asked. Imagine how many ways a person can be sick or injured. Now imagine trying to come up with a single yes-no question for each sickness or injury. Closed-ended questions typically provide limited information, and you should consider the answers to these questions as only a starting point toward understanding the patient's condition. Before beginning your interview with a patient, determine which provider will lead the interview. This will ensure that you and your partner do not ask questions at the same time or ask repetitive questions. When you are asking questions of the patient, be conscious of how many questions you are asking. How are you doing today? Have you been feeling ill? This common approach actually asks the patient two kinds of questions, one open-ended and one closed-ended. Often the patient will respond with a simple yes. To avoid this situation, it is best to ask a single question, wait for an answer, and then proceed to another question. There are many powerful communication tools you can use when trying to obtain information from patients. Sometimes patients will hide information, either consciously or unconsciously, due to fear or confusion. There are certain techniques that will assist you in gathering patient information. They can be helpful to use not only with patients who are willing to share, but with those who are resistant to sharing information. When you interview the patient, consider using touch as a means to communicate caring and compassion. Touch is a powerful tool. Therefore, keep in mind that it should be used consciously and sparingly. Many people will be uncomfortable with a stranger touching them suddenly. If you are going to touch the patient, approach slowly and touch the patient's shoulder or arm respectfully. You can consider holding the patient's hand. This allows you to touch the patient, showing you care about what he or she is telling you, and also allows you to remain at a slight distance. Avoid touching the patient's torso, chest, or face simply as a means of communication, because these areas are often viewed as intimate. Also, to touch these areas, you will need to get closer to the patient, potentially invading the patient's intimate space. The presence of family, friends, and bystanders during your interview of the patient can be valuable. Sometimes, however, well-meaning family members will speak for the patient, and, at times, you may need to ask the family member to allow the patient to answer. Ultimately, you will need to assess the situation and determine whether the additional people are helping you care for the patient or hindering your efforts. Do not be afraid to ask others to step outside or step aside for a moment while you talk with the patient. It is generally best to keep families together, but in cases where a family member is not helpful, consider giving him or her a task to do, such as gathering medications or clothing. This task can transform the person from a hindrance into a valuable aid. take into account how the patient will feel without his or her loved ones nearby. Separating them may make the patient more anxious. These 10 golden rules will help you to calm and reassure your patient and provide a therapeutic rapport. 1. Make and keep eye contact with your patient at all times. Give the patient your undivided attention. This will let the patient know that he or she is your top priority. Look the patient straight in the eye to establish a rapport. Establishing a rapport is building a trusting relationship with your patient. This will make caring for the patient much easier. 2. Provide your name and use the patient's proper name. Introduce yourself and your partner. If your department provides you with a name tag, wear it. Ask the patient what he or she wishes to be called. Avoid using terms such as honey or dear. Use a patient's first name only if the patient is a child or the patient asks you to use his or her first name. Rather, use a courtesy title, such as Mr. Peters, Mrs. Smith, or Ms. Butler. If you do not know the patient's name, refer to him or her as sir or ma'am. 3. Tell the patient the truth. Even if you have to say something very unpleasant, telling the truth is better than lying. Lying will destroy the patient's trust in you and decrease your own confidence. You might not always tell the patient everything, but if the patient or a family member asks a specific question, you should answer truthfully. A direct question deserves a direct answer. If you do not know the answer to a patient's question, say so. For example, a patient may ask, "Am I having a heart attack?" To which you would answer, "I don't know, but we will certainly get more information at the hospital. Right now, I am caring for you just like I would care for someone who is having a heart attack." 4. Use language that the patient can understand. Do not talk up or down to the patient in any way. Avoid technical medical terms that the patient might not understand. For example, ask the patient whether he or she has a history of heart problems. This will usually result in more accurate information than if you ask about previous episodes of myocardial infarction or a history of cardiomyopathy. 5. Be careful what you say about the patient to others. You need to understand the relationship between the person you are talking with, such as a bystander, and the patient. Ask the patient if it is okay for you to talk with this person. While speaking to others, ensure that you leave the general area of the patient if you must have a confidential conversation. Be mindful that sharing patient information may be a HIPAA violation. Do not talk about the patient in front of him or her. To do so gives the impression that the patient has no choice in his or her medical care. This is easy to forget when the patient has impaired cognitive, thought processes, or has difficulty communicating. 6. Be aware of your body language. Nonverbal communication is extremely important in dealing with patients. In stressful situations, patients may interpret your gestures and movements. Be particularly careful not to appear frustrated or threatening. Instead, position yourself at the same level or at a lower level than the patient when practical. Remember that you should always conduct yourself in a calm, professional manner. 7. Always speak slowly, clearly, and distinctly. Pay close attention to your tone of voice. 8. If the patient is hard of hearing, face the person so that he or she can read your lips. Try lowering or raising the tone of your voice. Some people who are hard of hearing can hear certain pitches better than others. Do not shout at a person who is hard of hearing. Shouting will not make it any easier for the patient to hear you and may frighten the patient. Never assume that an older patient is hard of hearing or otherwise unable to understand you. Also, never use baby talk with older patients or with anyone other than infants. If you are unable to communicate with a patient, have your partner try. Another technique is to have the patient put the stethoscope in his or her ears while you speak softly into the diaphragm to help amplify the sound. 9. Allow time for the patient to answer or respond to your questions. Do not rush a patient unless there is immediate danger. Sick and injured people may not be thinking clearly and may need time to answer even simple questions. This is especially true when treating older patients. 10. Act and speak in a calm, confident manner while caring for the patient. Make sure you attend to the patient's pain and needs. Try to make the patient physically comfortable and relaxed. Find out whether the patient is more comfortable sitting or lying down. Is the patient cold or hot? Does the patient want a friend or relative nearby? Patients literally place their lives in your hands. They deserve to know that you can provide medical care and that you are concerned about their well-being. These 10 golden rules will help provide a good foundation and will make it easier to gather information when the patient wants to talk. Sometimes you need to gather information from a reluctant audience. Patients may be defensive about their problems and may not want to talk about them because they are embarrassed. They may direct the conversation away from the true problem. With these patients, start the conversation as usual. Introduce yourself. Be open and compassionate. If you find yourself not getting any real answers, then consider one of the therapeutic communication techniques. Communicating with older patients. According to the U.S. Census Bureau in 2013, nearly 45 million people were older than 65 years. It is projected that by the year 2030, the geriatric population will number more than 70 million, resulting in an ever-increasing number of encounters with people in this category. However, a person's actual age might not be the most important factor in classifying him or her as geriatric. It is more important to determine a person's functional age. The functional age relates to the person's ability to function in daily activities, the person's mental state, health status, and activity pattern. As an EMS provider, when you enter a scene to care for an older patient, you are being asked to take control. You have been called because a person needs help. What you say and how you say it has an impact on the patient's perception of the call. You should present yourself as competent, confident, and caring. You must take charge of the situation, but do so with compassion. You are there to listen and act on what you learn. Don't limit your assessment to the obvious problem. Oftentimes, older patients who express that they are not well, or who are overly concerned about their health or general condition, are at risk for a serious decline in their physical, emotional, or psychological state. Generally speaking, older people think clearly, can give you a clear medical history, and are able to answer your questions appropriately. Do not assume that an older patient is senile or confused. Conversely, communicating with some older patients is extremely difficult, and you may encounter hostility, irritability, and in fact, some confusion. Do not assume this to be normal behavior for an older patient. These signs may be caused by a simple lack of oxygen, hypoxia, brain injury, including a cerebrovascular accident, unintentional drug overdose, infection, abnormal blood glucose, or even insufficient perfusion, circulation of blood, and, therefore, nutrients to the cells. Never attribute altered mental status to old age. In addition, your older patients may have difficulty hearing or seeing you. Therefore, you need great patience and compassion when you are called on to care for such a patient. Think of the patient as someone's grandmother or grandfather, or even as yourself when you reach that age. Approach an older patient slowly and calmly. Allow plenty of time for the patient to respond to your questions. Watch for signs of confusion, anxiety, or impaired hearing or vision. The patient should feel confident that you are in charge and that everything possible is being done for him or her. Older patients often do not feel much pain. An older person who has fallen or been injured may report no pain. In addition, older patients might not be fully aware of important changes in their body systems. Therefore, be especially vigilant for objective changes, no matter how subtle, in their condition. Objective changes are those that any observer would be able to witness. Respiratory rate, heart rate, sweating, or vomiting are all objective. Subjective findings are those that only the patient can experience, such as pain or nausea. Even minor changes in breathing or mental state may signal major problems. When possible, give the patient time to pack a few personal items before leaving for the hospital. Be sure to locate hearing aids, eyeglasses, or dentures before departure. It will make the patient's hospital stay far more pleasant. You should document on the patient care report, PCR, that these items accompanied the patient to the hospital and the person to whom they were given in the ED. Older patients are often worried about the safety of their home, valuable items, and pets. Take the time to share these concerns with the person assuming care of the patient at the hospital. Communicating with children. Everyone who is thrust into an emergency situation becomes frightened to some degree. However, fear is probably most obvious and severe in children. Children may be frightened by your uniform, the ambulance, and the number of people who have suddenly gathered around. Even a child who says little may be very much aware of all that is going on. Familiar faces and objects will help to reduce this fright. Let a child keep a favorite toy, doll, or security blanket to give the child some sense of control and comfort. Having a family member or friend nearby is also helpful. When not impractical due to the child's condition, it is often helpful to let the parent or a guardian hold the child during your evaluation and treatment. However, you will have to make sure this person will not upset the child or prevent the child from telling you important information. Sometimes, adult family members are not helpful because they become too upset by what has happened or the child will not share important information in front of them. An overly anxious parent or relative can make things worse. Be careful about selecting the proper adult for this role. Children can easily see through lies or deceptions, so you must always be honest with them. Make sure that you explain to the child over and over again what and why certain things are happening. If treatment is going to hurt, such as applying a splint, tell the child ahead of time. Respect a child's modesty. Children are often embarrassed if they have to undress or be undressed in front of strangers. This anxiety often intensifies during adolescence. When a wound or site of injury has to be exposed, try to do so out of the sight of strangers, and when appropriate, be sure to have a parent or guardian present. Again, it is extremely important to tell the child what you are doing and why you are doing it. You should speak to a child in a professional yet friendly way. When speaking to a child, make sure to use an appropriate tone and vocabulary. A child should feel reassured that you are there to help in every way possible. Maintain eye contact with a child, as you would with an adult, to let the child know that you are there to help and that you can be trusted. It is helpful to position yourself at the child's eye level so you do not appear to tower above the child. Communicating with patients who are deaf or hard of hearing. Patients who are hard of hearing are usually not ashamed or embarrassed by their disability. Often, it is the people around a person who is hard of hearing who have problems coping. Remember that you must be able to communicate with patients who are hard of hearing so you can provide necessary or even life-saving care. Most patients who are hard of hearing have normal intelligence and can easily understand what is going on around them, provided you can successfully communicate with them. Most patients who are hard of hearing can read lips to some extent. Therefore, you should place yourself in a position so the patient can see your lips. Many patients who are hard of hearing have hearing aids to help them communicate. Be careful that hearing aids are not lost during an accident or fall. Hearing aids may also be forgotten if the patient is confused or ill. Look around for one in the immediate area or ask the patient or family about use of a hearing aid. Remember the following 5 steps to efficiently communicate with patients who are hard of hearing. 1. Have paper and a pen available. This way you can write down questions and the patient can write down answers if necessary. Be sure to print so that your handwriting is not a communication barrier. 2. If the patient can read lips, you should face the patient and speak slowly and distinctly. Do not cover your mouth or mumble. If it is dark, consider shining a light on your face. 3. Never shout. This will not help the patient hear you and may frighten him or her. 4. Be sure to listen carefully, ask short questions, and give short answers. Remember that although many patients who are hard of hearing can speak distinctly, some cannot. 5. Learn some simple phrases in sign language. For example, knowing the signs for sick, hurt, and help may be useful if you cannot communicate in any other way. Communicating with visually impaired patients. Like patients who are hard of hearing, visually impaired and blind patients have usually accepted and learned to deal with their disability. Of course, visually impaired patients are not necessarily completely blind. Many can perceive light and dark or can see shadows or movement. Ask the patient whether he or she can see at all. Also remember, as with other patients who have disabilities, you should expect visually impaired patients to have normal intelligence. As you begin caring for a visually impaired patient, explain everything you are doing in detail as you are doing it. Be sure to stay in physical contact with the patient as you begin your care. Place your hand lightly on the patient's shoulder or arm and try to avoid sudden movements. If the patient can walk to the ambulance, guide him or her by placing his or her hand on your arm, taking care not to rush. Transport with the patient any mobility aids, such as a cane, to the hospital. A visually impaired person may have a guide dog. Guide dogs are easily identified by their special harnesses. They are trained to not leave their masters and to not respond to strangers. A visually impaired patient who is conscious can tell you about the dog and give instructions for its care. The following rare situations are difficult to manage. If the patient is very stable, you should consider bringing the guide dog to the hospital in the back of the ambulance with the patient because it will help to alleviate some of the stress for both the patient and the dog. If the patient is unstable, the dog is injured or unruly, or for other safety or patient care reasons, it is inappropriate to transport the dog, then you should make arrangements for the care of the dog. Contact your supervisor for assistance. The exact method for managing a patient with a guide dog or other medical care animal will be outlined in your department's policies and procedures. Follow your local protocols. Communicating with non-English speaking patients. Part of patient care includes obtaining a medical history from the patient. You cannot skip this step simply because the patient does not speak English. Most patients who do not speak English fluently will still know certain important words or phrases. Your first step is to find out how much English the patient can speak. Use short, simple questions and simple words whenever possible, and avoid difficult medical terms. You can help patients better understand if you point to specific parts of the body as you ask questions. Speaking louder will not increase a patient's ability to understand you. In many areas, particularly large urban centers, major segments of the population do not speak English. Your job will be much easier if you learn some common words and phrases in their language, especially common medical terms. Pocket cards that show the pronunciation of these terms are available. If the patient does not speak any English, use a smartphone app or website to help you translate or find an interpreter. In an emergency, it may be necessary to have a family member or friend translate until a professional interpreter is located. Also, remember to request a translator at the hospital while providing the radio report if the patient's language is known. Hospitals must have professional foreign language interpreters in-house or on call for this purpose. Communicating with other healthcare professionals. Effective communication between the EMT and healthcare professionals in the receiving facility is an essential cornerstone of efficient, effective, and appropriate patient care. Your reporting responsibilities do not end when you arrive at the hospital. In fact, they have just begun. The transfer of care officially occurs during your oral report at the hospital. Once you arrive at the hospital, a hospital staff member will take responsibility for the patient from you. However, you may only transfer the care of your patient to someone with at least your level of training. In the hospital, this is a paramedic, nurse, or physician. Once a staff member is ready to take responsibility for the patient, you must provide that person with a formal oral report of the patient's condition. Giving a report is a long-standing and well-documented endpoint in transferring the patient's care from one provider to another. Your oral report is usually given at the same time that the staff member is providing care for the patient. For example, a nurse or physician may start assessing the patient or help you to move the patient from the stretcher to an examination table. Therefore, you must report important information in a complete and precise way. The following six components must be included in the oral report. 1. Opening information that includes the patient's name, if you know it, chief complaint, nature of the illness, or mechanism of injury. For example, "Good morning, this is Mrs. McCarty. She is 65 years old and reports back pain. She woke up around 0300, tripped, and fell into the bathtub after using the restroom." 2. Detailed information that was not provided during the radio report. For example, "She denies a loss of consciousness, states that she has no history of stroke, TIAs, or cardiac compromise, but has been feeling a little lightheaded when she stands." 3. Any important history that was not already provided. For example, "Mrs. McCarty lives by herself. She was unable to get out of the tub and was found by a hospice worker at 1000 this morning. We suspect hypothermia because she had a core temperature of 94 degrees. 4. The patient's response to treatment given en route. It is especially important to report any changes in the patient or the treatment provided since your initial radio report. For example, "Although we suspected that the patient's mid-back pain was a result of her leaning against the faucet of the bathtub for 7 hours, we put her in the Kendrick extrication device for both precautionary and extrication reasons. Hot packs wrapped in hand towels were used to help warm her up." 5. Vital signs, assessed during transport and after the radio report. For example, "Her vitals include a blood pressure of 112 over 84 millimeters mercury, a pulse of 72 beats per minute, respiration of 14 beats per minute, and core body temperature of 94 degrees at the time of transport. They are generally unchanged since then, except that her last temperature was 96 degrees. 6. Other information you may have gathered that was not important enough to report sooner. Information that was gathered during transport, patient medications you brought with you, known allergies, and any other details about the patient that were provided by family members or friends may be included. For example, Mrs. Woods, the home hospice worker, has contacted Mrs. McCarty's family and followed us here to answer any questions. You can use the same process described for giving an oral report if you need to transfer care during an EMS event. For example, if there are multiple patients, you may need to remain on the scene while someone else continues the assessment you began. Begin the oral report with a quick introduction, letting the other EMS provider know who you are and your level of licensure. You should then continue to transfer care just as you would inside the hospital. You will also need to communicate routinely with many other professionals, police, social service personnel, fire personnel, and other EMS providers. Make sure your language and general demeanor are professional. Remember that federal laws protect a patient's right to privacy and that you should not give any health information about your patient to anyone other than those directly involved in the care of the patient. As an EMT, you must be able to quickly and accurately find out what the patient needs and be able to tell others. Never forget that you are the vital link between the patient and the healthcare team. Written communications and documentation. The Patient Care Report, PCR, also known as a pre-hospital care report, is the legal document used to record all aspects of the care your patient received, from initial dispatch to arrival at the hospital. Either term can be used and both are acceptable. You may be able to complete the report en route to the hospital if the trip is long enough and the patient needs minimal care. Usually, you will finish the report after you have transferred care of the patient to an ED staff member. There are two types of PCRs, written and electronic, ePCRs, which will be discussed later in this chapter. The information you collect during a call becomes part of the PCR, and that information is ultimately entered into a data pool. The National Emergency Medical Services Information System, NEMSIS, has been collecting pre-hospital care information for research purposes since the early 1970s. NEMSIS has identified specific data points, uniform components, needed to enable communication and comparison of EMS runs between agencies, regions, and states. The minimum dataset includes both narrative components and checkboxes. If you go to www.ems.gov, you can see the national dataset and discover interesting facts about delivery of EMS within the United States. Because EMS systems track their own time, make sure that your watch is synchronized with dispatch time at the beginning of the shift, if that is procedure. Another way you can manage this information is to contact the dispatcher and have him or her provide you with the time. Either way, it is important to be able to keep close track of time. Accurate documentation will depend on it. You will begin gathering patient information as soon as you reach the patient. Continue collecting information as you provide care until you arrive at the hospital. Patient Care Report. As discussed, a PCR helps ensure efficient continuity of patient care. This report describes the nature of the patient's injuries or illness at the scene and the initial treatment you provide. Although this report might not be read immediately at the hospital, it may be referred to later for important information. The report serves the following six functions. 1. Continuity of care. 2. Legal documentation. 3. Education. 4. Administrative information. 5. Essential research record. 6. Evaluation and continuous quality improvement. A good PCR documents any changes in the patient's condition upon arrival at the hospital. It is critical that you document everything in the clearest manner possible because the report serves multiple purposes. The information in the report will help to prove that you have provided a standard of care and, in some instances, shows you have properly handled unusual or uncommon situations. Both objective and subjective information is included in this report. The following are examples of information collected on a PCR. Chief complaint. Level of consciousness, according to the AVPU scale, or mental status, Vital signs. Initial assessment. Patient demographics, age, gender, ethnic background. Should you ever be called to provide testimony concerning patient care, you and your PCR will be used to present evidence. As with your personal appearance, your PCR will reflect a professional or a non-professional image. A neat, concise, well-written document, including correct spelling and grammar, will reflect good patient care. Consider the adage, if the report looks sloppy, the patient care was also sloppy. These reports also provide valuable administrative information, such as that used for patient billing. Information included in PCRs can be used to evaluate response times, equipment usage, and other areas of administrative responsibility. The following are examples of administrative information gathered from a PCR. Time the incident was reported. Time the EMS unit was notified. Time the EMS unit arrived at the scene. Time the EMS unit left the scene. Time the EMS unit arrived at the receiving facility. Time the patient care was transferred. It is standard procedure to use military time in EMS documentation. This ensures that each time is unique. For example, 12 noon cannot be confused with 12 midnight. Data may be obtained from the PCR to analyze causes, severity, and types of illness or injury requiring emergency medical care. These reports may also be used in an ongoing program for evaluation of the quality of patient care. All reports are periodically reviewed by your system to make sure trauma triage and/or other pre-hospital care criteria have been met. There are many requirements of a PCR. Often, these requirements vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, mainly because different agencies obtain information from them. Although no universally accepted form exists, certain uniform data points are common in all areas. The benefits of collecting such information are significant, one being that national trends can be detected. For example, roughly 15% of the nation's EMS calls involve children ages 0 to 9 years. Of those patients, 3% will have a respiratory complaint. Such information is invaluable. Finally, PCRs are used by individual agencies to determine patterns of EMS responses. Busy times and high call volume areas can be predictive, and a thorough review of PCRs can set the stage for scheduling shifts and for system status management, including where units are placed. Types of forms. You will most likely use one of two types of forms. The first type is the traditional written form with checkboxes and a narrative section. The second type is a computerized version or electronic PCR, ePCR, in which you fill in information using a computer or tablet device that uploads data over a secure internet connection. EMS agencies across the country are replacing written reports with an electronic reporting system. Electronic PCRs have several advantages over the written forms. For example, ePCRs allow you to transmit patient information directly to hospital computers for review by the physician, pharmacy, and other professionals providing patient care. If your service uses written forms, be sure to fill in the boxes completely and avoid making stray marks on the sheet. Make sure that you are familiar with the specific procedures for collecting, recording, and reporting the information in your area. Regardless of which format is used to collect information, you must complete a narrative section. For this information to be valuable, it must be correct. Therefore, you should make every effort to ensure the information is accurate. The narrative section of the PCR is arguably the most important portion. Here you will describe all of the facts related to the EMS call. The narrative should tell the story and present a clear, detailed picture of what you found, what you did, and how it affected the patient's condition. Be sure to include significant negative findings and important observations about the scene. Make sure that what you write is not an opinion, but fact based on findings. For example, you may write, "The patient admits to drinking today," or "The patient smelled of alcohol." These are clear descriptions that do not make any judgments about the patient's condition. However, stating, "The patient was drunk," is a personal judgment that may not be able to be supported. Choose your words carefully and thoughtfully. Your job is to reproduce the important facts of the EMS call in writing. The narrative section of the PCR needs to include the following information: time of events, assessment findings, emergency medical care provided, changes in the patient after treatment, observations at the scene, final patient disposition, refusal of care, staff person who continued care. In written documentation, avoid radio codes and use only standard abbreviations, a list of which should be provided by your department. Remember, EMS personnel are not the only people who will be reading this document. Other hospital and billing personnel will need to read and understand what has been written. When information is of a sensitive nature, note the source of the information. Be sure to spell words correctly, especially medical terms. If you do not know the correct spelling of a particular word, find out how to spell it or use another word. Also, be sure to record the time with all assessment findings. Whether you completed a medical or trauma assessment, the assessment-based approach follows each step of the assessments as a guideline to narrative writing. Remember that the report form itself, and all the information in it, is considered a confidential document. Be sure you are familiar with state and local laws concerning confidentiality. All pre-hospital forms must be handled with care and stored in an appropriate manner once you have completed them. After you have completed a report, distribute copies to the appropriate locations according to state and local protocol. In most instances, a copy of the report will remain at the hospital and will become part of the patient's medical record. Depending on the requirements of the EMS system in which you work, you may not have the time to complete the full PCR while at the hospital. Some EMS systems allow for a shorter, modified version of the PCR to be left at the hospital, and the full report can be completed at the station or transmitted electronically. Even in these circumstances, however, a written record should be left with the patient. In these cases, most systems will have a drop report or transfer report. These single-page abbreviated forms are used as a memory aid during an EMS call. If you are unable to remain at the hospital to complete the PCR, copy these documents and leave them with the nurse or doctor. Reporting errors. Everyone makes mistakes. If you leave something out of a report or record information incorrectly, do not try to cover it up. Rather, write down what did or did not happen and the steps that were taken to correct the situation. Falsifying information on the PCR may result in suspension and/or revocation of your certification or license, as well as legal implications. More important, falsifying information results in poor patient care because other healthcare providers have a false impression of assessment findings or the treatment given. For example, if you did not give the patient oxygen, do not document that the patient was given oxygen. Document only the vital signs that were actually taken. A classic case of improper documentation occurs with cardiac arrest patients. Consider this scenario. Under vital signs, an EMT documents pulse 0 beats per minute, respiration 0 breaths per minute, and blood pressure 0/0 mmHg. What the EMT meant to document was the application of a blood pressure cuff, inflating it and deflating it while listening for a pulse. Someone reviewing the PCR after the call may ask why the EMT took the time to check the blood pressure on a patient who didn't have a pulse instead of performing CPR. What if the wrong drug or the wrong dose is given to a patient? What if the patient is accidentally dropped? Unfortunately, these things can and do happen. It is important that you document the event. Do not lie or cover it up. In your narrative, provide a factual account of what happened. For example, ordered 1 sublingual nitroglycerin. Given 2 sublingual nitroglycerin. Patient blood pressure checked following administration. No changes noted. Or, while loading the patient into the ambulance, the patient was dropped. Patient was on the ambulance cot when it fell a total of 4 feet. Patient was not thrown off cot. Patient was assessed after being dropped and reported feeling scared and having neck pain. Hospital advised. If you discover an error as you are writing your report, draw a single horizontal line through the error, initial it, and write the correct information next to it. Do not try to erase or cover the error with correction fluid. This may be interpreted as an attempt to cover up a mistake. If an error is discovered after you submit your report, follow the same process of error correction by drawing a single line through the error, preferably in a different color ink, initialing it, and dating it. Make sure to add a note with the correct information. If you accidentally left out information, begin the new section with the word addendum, add the new information, and then add the date and your initials. When using a paper system, you may be able to add addendums using specific addendum forms. If you are using an electronic documentation system, refer to the system's direction as how to make an amendment to the original document. Most electronic systems will allow for amendments but will prevent erasure in a completed document. Documenting refusal of care. Refusal of care is a common source of litigation in EMS. Therefore, thorough documentation is crucial. As discussed in Chapter 3, Medical, Legal, and Ethical Issues, competent adult patients have the right to refuse treatment and, in fact, must specifically provide permission for treatment to be initiated. If you are not able to persuade the patient to proceed with treatment, document any patient assessment findings, emergency medical care given, your efforts to obtain consent, and the patient's response to your efforts. Have the patient sign a refusal form. You should also have a family member, police officer, or bystander sign the form as a witness. If the patient refuses to sign the refusal form, have a family member, police officer, or bystander sign the form verifying that the patient refused to sign. Inform online medical control when patients refuse care. Even if a patient refuses care, you must complete the PCR. You will need to document the advice you gave as to the risks associated with refusal of care. Report clinical information, such as the LOC, showing the competency of the person refusing care. Note pertinent patient comments and any medical advice given to the patient by the physician or medical control through phone or radio. Also, include a description of the care that you wish to provide for the patient. There are many local variations of requirements for patient refusals. Refusal of care not only includes patients who do not wish to be transported to the hospital, but also those who refuse a certain aspect of care. For example, a victim of a car crash may wish to be treated and transported, but refuses to be appropriately immobilized. In these instances, you should carry out all other medical care and document the patient's refusal of spinal immobilization. Just because the patient refuses a cervical collar is no reason to deny oxygen. The same is true for the patient who wishes to use a local hospital when the injuries dictate transport to a trauma facility. Anytime a patient refuses any part of the standard treatment, it is to be documented in the PCR. Special reporting situations. In some situations, you may be required to file special reports with appropriate authorities. These situations may involve gunshot wounds, dog bites, certain infectious diseases, or suspected physical or sexual abuse. Learn your local requirements for reporting these incidents. Failure to report them may have legal consequences. It is important that the report be accurate, objective, and submitted in a timely manner. Another special reporting situation is a multiple casualty incident, MCI. The local MCI plan should have some means of temporarily recording important medical information, such as a triage tag that can be used later to complete the form. The standard for completing the form in an MCI is not the same as for a typical call. Your local plan should have specific guidelines. MCIs will be discussed in Chapter 39, Incident Management. Communications, Systems, and Equipment. Radio and telephone communications link you and your team with other members of the EMS, fire, and law enforcement communities. This link helps the entire team to work together more effectively and provides an important layer of safety and protection for each member of the team. You must know what your system can and cannot do, and you must be able to use your system efficiently and effectively. You must be able to send precise, accurate reports about the scene, the patient's condition, and the treatment that you provide. As an EMT, you must be familiar with two-way radio communications and have a working knowledge of the mobile and handheld portable radios that are used in your unit. You must also know when to use them and what to say when you are transmitting. Base station radios. The dispatcher usually communicates with field units by transmitting through a fixed radio base station that is controlled from the dispatch center. A base station is any radio hardware containing a transmitter and receiver that is located in a fixed place. The base station may be used by an operator speaking into a microphone that is connected directly to the equipment. It also works remotely through telephone lines or by radio from a communications center. Base stations may include dispatch centers, fire stations, ambulance bases, or hospitals. A two-way radio consists of two units, a transmitter and a receiver. Some base stations may have more than one transmitter and/or more than one receiver. They may also be equipped with one multi-channel transmitter and several single-channel receivers. A channel is an assigned frequency or frequencies used to carry voice and/or data communications. Regardless of the number of transmitters and receivers, they are commonly called base radios or stations. Base stations usually have more power, often 100 watts or more, and higher, more efficient antenna systems than mobile or portable radios. This increased broadcasting range allows the base station operator to communicate with field units and other stations at much greater distances. The base radio must be physically close to its antenna. Therefore, the actual base station cabinet and hardware are commonly found on the roof of a tall building or at the bottom of an antenna tower. The base station operator may be miles away in a dispatch center or hospital, communicating with a base station radio by dedicated lines or special radio links. A dedicated line, also known as a hotline, is used for specific point-to-point contact. This type of phone, typically located within an ED, is not on the main switchboard. EMS personnel are able to call the number directly without being placed on hold or transferred. This type of line makes recording medical command conversations much easier. Mobile and portable radios. In the ambulance, you will use both mobile and portable radios to communicate with the dispatcher and/or medical control. An ambulance will often have more than one mobile radio, each on a different frequency. One radio may be used to communicate with the dispatcher or other public safety agencies. A second radio is often used for communicating patient information to medical control. A mobile radio is installed in a vehicle and usually operates at lower power than a base station. Most VHF, very high frequency, mobile radios operate between 30 and 300 MHz. UHF, ultra-high frequency, mobile radios operate between 300 MHz and 3000 MHz. Radios that operate at 800 MHz are increasingly common in EMS systems. These systems provide a great amount of system flexibility without the need for vast numbers of frequencies. What was once accomplished with 30 separate frequencies can be done with less than 10. Mobile antennas are much closer to the ground than base station antennas, so communications from the unit are typically limited to 10 to 15 miles over average terrain. Portable radios are handheld devices that operate at 1 to 5 watts of power. Because the entire radio can be held in your hand, when in use, the antenna is often no taller than you. The transmission range of a portable radio is more limited than that of a mobile or base station radios. Portable radios are essential in helping to coordinate EMS activities at the scene of an MCI. They are also helpful when you are away from the ambulance and need to communicate with dispatch, another unit, or medical control. Repeater-based systems. A repeater is a special base station radio that receives messages and signals on one frequency and then automatically retransmits them on a second frequency. Because a repeater is a base station with a large antenna, it is able to receive lower power signals, such as those from a portable radio, from a long distance away. The signal is then rebroadcast with all the power of the base station. EMS systems that use repeaters usually have outstanding system-wide communications and are able to get the best signal from portable radios. There are also mobile repeaters that may be found in ambulances or placed in various areas around an EMS system area. At times, you may be able to communicate with a base station radio, but you will not be able to hear or transmit to another mobile unit that is also communicating with that base. Repeater base stations eliminate such problems. They allow two mobile or portable units that cannot reach each other directly to communicate through the repeater using its greater power and antenna. Digital equipment. Although most people think of voice communications when they think of two-way radios, digital signals are also a part of EMS communications. With telemetry, electronic signals are converted into coded, audible signals. These signals can then be transmitted by radio or telephone to a receiver with a decoder at the hospital. The decoder converts the signals back into electronic impulses that can be displayed on a screen or printed, such as a fax message. New technology also allows for digital telemetry. For example, data from cardiac monitors can be transmitted via Bluetooth-enabled mobile devices to a monitoring center, where physicians can review the data and quickly contact patients if needed. Rhythm strips and 12-lead ECGs are transmitted to the hospital to identify abnormal heart rhythms and critical cardiac information, such as ST segment elevation myocardial infarction or STEMI alerts, allowing informed treatment decisions to be made during the pre-hospital phase. Digital signals are also used in some kinds of paging and tone alerting systems because they transmit faster than spoken words and allow more choices and flexibility. Cellular, satellite telephones. Whereas dispatchers communicate with field units by transmitting through a fixed radio base station, it is common for EMTs to communicate with receiving facilities by cellular telephone. These telephones are simply low-power portable radios that communicate through a series of interconnected repeater stations called cells, hence the name cellular. Cells are linked by a sophisticated computer system and connected to the telephone network. Another option is a sat phone or satellite phone. These phones use a satellite which receives and relays the signals instead of a cell. Many cellular systems make equipment and airtime available to EMS services at little or no cost as a public service. The public is often able to call 911 or other emergency numbers on a cellular telephone free of charge. However, this easy access may result in overloading and jamming of cellular systems in multiple casualty and disaster situations. When using these systems, ensure that a reference of commonly called numbers is available. Local hospitals, poison control, police services, and the number to the dispatcher should be readily available. Cellular and satellite systems also have areas of bad reception. As an EMT, it is important to be aware of any areas in which your equipment will not work. As with all repeater-based systems, a cellular or satellite telephone is useless if the equipment fails, if there is a loss of power, or if it is damaged by severe weather or other circumstances. A scanner is a radio receiver that searches or scans across several frequencies, stops whenever it receives a radio broadcast on that frequency, and continues once the message is complete. Although cellular and satellite telephones are more private than most other forms of radio communications, keep in mind that these telephones use digital signals, which makes eavesdropping difficult but not impossible. Therefore, you must always be careful to appropriately respect patient privacy and to speak in a professional manner every time you use any form of an EMS communications system. Other communications equipment. Ambulances and other field units are usually equipped with an external public address system. This system may be a part of the siren or the mobile radio. The intercom between the cab and the patient compartment may also be part of the mobile radio. These components do not involve radio wave transmission, but you must understand how they work and practice using them before you really need them. EMS systems may use a variety of two-way radio hardware. Some systems operate VHF equipment in the simplex, push-to-talk, release-to-listen mode. In this mode, radio transmissions can occur in either direction, but not simultaneously in both. When one party transmits, the other can only receive. Once one party finishes transmitting, the other party can then reply. Other systems conduct duplex, simultaneous talk-listen communications on UHF frequencies and other cellular telephones. In the full duplex mode, radios can simultaneously transmit and receive communications on one channel. This is sometimes called a pair of frequencies. A third possible configuration for a communications system is multiplex. This design utilizes two or more frequencies, which enables more than one transmission to occur simultaneously and provides for the transmission of both audio and data signals via separate channels. This type of system is what allows paramedics to transmit a patient's electrocardiogram to the hospital from the scene or back of the ambulance. A number of VHF and UHF channels, commonly called MED channels, are reserved exclusively for EMS use. However, hundreds of other commercial, local government, and fire services frequencies are also used for EMS communications. Trunking, or 800 MHz systems, take advantage of the latest technologies in communications. Instead of being assigned to one or two frequencies, in a trunking system, many frequencies are assigned to a group. As the radio conversation begins, a computer selects the next open frequency and you begin talking. When you speak a second time, you will likely be speaking on a different frequency because the computer is constantly monitoring for frequency load and reassigning transmissions to unused frequencies. These systems allow for greater traffic without greater numbers of frequencies. Therefore, you do not need to worry about being able to transmit or receive. In a trunking system, the computer will switch you to another channel without your knowledge and you will operate the radio as you normally do. Any large-scale emergency requires cooperative efforts from several agencies such as law enforcement, fire departments, and EMS. At times, more than one jurisdiction is involved, and effective communication between all of those involved becomes challenging. An interoperable communications system allows all of the agencies involved to share valuable information with each other in real time. This system utilizes a voice-over internet protocol format to connect landlines, cell phones, and computers to create a seamless, reliable exchange of information between all parties. Another type of communication system is a mobile data terminal, MDT. An MDT is a small computer terminal inside the ambulance that directly receives data from the dispatch center. MDTs allow for greatly expanded communication capabilities. Instead of asking the dispatcher to confirm whether he said 11345 Main Street or 11354 Main Street, you look at the terminal where the address is displayed. Satellite communications can track your progress to the scene and can provide important scene information, such as known violent calls to this address, the nature of those calls, and the number of times the ambulance has been called. Your ability to effectively communicate with other units or medical control depends on how well the weaker radio can talk back. Base and repeater station radios often have higher antennas and much greater power than mobile or portable units do. This increased power ensures that signals are generally heard and understood from a far greater distance than the signal produced from a mobile unit. Remember, when you are at the scene, you may be able to clearly hear the dispatcher or hospital on your radio, but you may not be heard or understood when you transmit. Even small changes in your location can significantly affect the quality of your transmission. Also remember that the location of the antenna is critically important for clear transmission. Commercial aircraft flying at 37,000 feet can transmit and receive signals over hundreds of miles. Yet their radios have only a few watts of power. The power comes from their antenna positioned at 37,000 feet. The success of communications depends on the efficiency of your equipment. A damaged antenna or microphone often prevents high-quality communications. Check the condition and status of your equipment at the start of each shift and then correct or report any problems. Radio communications. All radio operations in the United States, including those used in EMS systems, are regulated by the Federal Communications Commission, FCC. The FCC has jurisdiction over interstate and international telephone and telegraph services and satellite communications, all of which may involve EMS activity. The FCC has five principal EMS-related responsibilities. 1. Allocate specific radio frequencies for use by EMS providers. Modern EMS communications began in 1974. At that time, the FCC assigned 10 MED channels in the 460 to 470 MHz UHF band to be used by EMS providers. These UHF channels were added to the several VHF frequencies that were already available for EMS systems. However, these VHF frequencies had to be shared with other special emergencies uses, including school buses and veterinarians. 2. License base stations and assign appropriate radio call signs for those stations. An FCC license is usually issued for 5 years, after which time it must be renewed. Each FCC license is granted only for a specific operating group. Often, the longitude and latitude, locations of the antenna, and the address of the base station determine the call signs. 3. Establish licensing standards and operating specifications for radio equipment used by EMS providers. Before it can be licensed, each piece of radio equipment must be submitted to the FCC by its manufacturer for type acceptance, based on established operating specifications and regulations. 4. Establish limitations for transmitter power output. The FCC regulates broadcasting power to reduce radio interference between neighboring communications systems. 5. Monitor radio operations. This includes making spot field checks to help ensure compliance with FCC rules and regulations. The FCC's rules and regulations are written in technical and legal language and fill many volumes. Only a very small section, Part 90, Subpart C, deals with EMS communication issues. You are not responsible for reading these detailed and often confusing documents. For appropriate guidance on technical issues, contact your EMS system supervisor. In fact, many EMS systems look to radio and telephone communications experts for advice on technical issues. Responding to the scene. EMS communication systems may operate on several frequencies and use different frequency bands. Some EMS systems may even use different radios for various purposes. However, all EMS systems depend on the skill of the dispatcher. The dispatcher receives the first call to 911. You are part of the team that responds to calls once the dispatcher notifies your unit of an emergency. the dispatcher has several important responsibilities during the alert and dispatch phase of EMS communications. The dispatcher must do all of the following. Properly screen and assign priority to each call, according to predetermined protocols. Select and alert the appropriate EMS response units. Dispatch and direct EMS response units to the correct location. Coordinate EMS response units with other public safety services until the incident is over. Provide emergency medical instructions to the telephone caller, according to predetermined protocols, so that essential care, for example CPR, may begin before the EMTs arrive. When the first call to 911 comes in, the dispatcher must judge its relative importance to begin the appropriate EMS response using emergency medical dispatch protocols. First, the dispatcher must find out the exact location of the patient and the nature and severity of the problem. The dispatcher asks for the caller's telephone number, the patient's name and age, and other information as directed by local protocol. Next, the dispatcher asks for some description of the scene, such as the number of patients or special environmental hazards. Using this information, the dispatcher will assign the appropriate EMS response unit or units based on local protocols and the following factors. Dispatcher's determination of the nature and severity of the problem. Many emergency medical dispatch systems will determine this automatically based on a caller's answers to a defined series of questions. Anticipated response time to the scene. Level of training, EMR, EMT, AEMT, paramedic, of available EMS response unit or units. Need for additional EMS units, fire suppression, rescue, a hazardous materials team, air medical support, or law enforcement. The dispatcher's next step is to alert the appropriate EMS response units. Alerting these units may be done in a variety of ways. The dispatcher may use the dispatch radio system to contact units that are already in service and monitoring the channel. Dedicated lines, hotlines, between the control center and the EMS station may also be used. The dispatcher may also page EMS personnel. Pagers are commonly used in EMS operations to alert on-duty and off-duty personnel. Paging involves the use of a coded tone or digital radio signal and a voice or display message that is transmitted to pagers, beepers, or desktop monitor radios. Paging signals may be sent to alert only certain personnel or may be blanket signals that will activate all the pagers in the EMS service. Pagers and monitor radios are convenient because they are usually silent until their specific paging code is received. Alerted personnel contact the dispatcher to confirm the message and receive details of their assignments. Once EMS personnel have been alerted, they must be properly dispatched and sent to the incident. Every EMS system should use a standard dispatching procedure. The dispatcher should give the responding unit or units the following information. Nature and severity of the injury, illness, or incident. Exact location of the incident. Number of patients. Responses by other public safety agencies. Special directions or advisories, such as adverse road or traffic conditions, severe weather reports, or potential scene hazards. Time at which the unit or units are dispatched. Your unit must confirm with the dispatcher that you have received the information and are en route to the scene. Local protocol will dictate whether it is the job of the dispatcher or your unit to notify other public safety agencies that you are responding to an emergency. In some areas, the ED is also notified when an ambulance responds to an emergency. You should report to the dispatcher any problems during your response. You should also inform the dispatcher when you have arrived at the scene. The arrival report to the dispatcher should include any obvious details that you see during scene size-up. For example, you might say, "Dispatcher, BLS Unit 2 is on scene at 3010 Mitchell Street. It is a blue house with a long driveway." This information is particularly useful if additional units are responding to the same scene. All radio communications during dispatch, as well as during other phases of operations, must be brief and easily understood. Speak in plain English and do not use code words in your transmissions. The use of 10 codes is specifically discouraged because they vary by jurisdiction and decrease the understandability of a transmission. Your tone and pace should be slow, relaxed, and clear. You do not need to use excessively polite language. Also avoid wordiness. An example of an excessively wordy communication is, "Good morning, dispatch. This is ambulance 631. We are responding to 381 South Main Street. Have a good day." Although this sounds pleasant and you should try to foster a good working environment with the dispatcher, this wastes radio time. Remember, the dispatcher's job is to field hundreds of calls an hour. Therefore, you need to only report important information so that he or she can focus on what to do next. EMS providers will need to use the radio to communicate with dispatch. Communicating with medical control and hospitals. The principal reason for radio communication is to facilitate communication between you and medical control, the hospital. Medical control may be located at the receiving hospital, another facility, or sometimes even in another city or state. You must, however, consult with medical control to notify the hospital of an incoming patient, request advice or receive orders, or advise the hospital of special situations. It is important to plan and organize your radio communication before you push the transmit button. Remember, a concise, well-organized report is the best method of accurately and thoroughly describing the patient and his or her medical condition to the providers who will be receiving the patient. It also demonstrates your competence and professionalism to all who hear your report. Well-organized radio communications with the hospital will engender confidence in the receiving facility's physicians and nurses, as well as others who are listening. In addition, the patient and family will be comforted by your organization and ability to communicate clearly. A well-delivered radio report puts you in control of the information, which is correct procedure. Hospital notification is the most common type of communication between you and the hospital. The purpose of these calls is to notify the receiving facility of the patient's chief complaint and condition. On the basis of this information, the ED is able to appropriately prepare staff and equipment to receive the patient. This is primarily a one-way form of communication. You are telling the ED what to expect. You are not asking for advice or orders. You are simply notifying them. Giving the patient report. The patient report should follow a standard format established by your EMS system. The report commonly includes the following 9 elements. 1. Your unit identification and level of services. Example, Columbus Fire 2 BLS. 2. The receiving hospital and your estimated time of arrival. Example, Columbus Community Hospital ETA 10 minutes, or patient transport code, according to local protocols. 3. The patient's age and gender. Example, an 86-year-old woman. The patient's name should not be given over the radio because it may be overheard. This would be a violation of the patient's privacy. 4. The patient's chief complaint or your perception of the problem and its severity. Example, patient reports severe pelvic and less severe back pain. 5. A brief history of the patient's current problem. Example, patient fell into bathtub at 0300 this morning and wasn't able to get out. Other important history information that may pertain to the current problem should also be included, such as the patient has diabetes and takes insulin. 6. A brief report of physical findings. This report should include level of consciousness, the patient's general appearance, pertinent abnormalities noted, and vital signs. Example, the patient is alert and oriented, has pale skin color, and is cold to the touch. We noted crepitus in the pelvic girdle. Her blood pressure is 112 over 84, pulse is 72, and respirations 14. 7. A brief summary of the care given and any patient response. Example, we have immobilized her onto a backboard. She still has pulse, motor, and sensory function distally in all 4 extremities. 8. A brief description of the patient's response to the treatment provided. 9. Determine whether the receiving facility has any additional questions or orders. Be sure you report all patient information in an objective, accurate, and professional manner. Remember that people with scanners are listening. You could be successfully sued for slander if you describe a patient in a way that injures his or her reputation. The role of medical control. The delivery of EMS involves an impressive array of assessments, stabilization, and treatments. In some cases, you may assist patients in taking medications. AEMTs and paramedics go beyond this level by initiating medication therapy based on the patient's presenting signs. For logical, ethical, and legal reasons, the delivery of such sophisticated care must be done in association with physicians. For this reason, every EMS system needs input and involvement from physicians, including your system or department medical director, providing medical direction, medical control, for your EMS system. medical control is either offline, indirect, or online, direct, as authorized by the medical director. Medical control guides the treatment of patients in the system through protocols, direct orders, advice, and post-call review. Depending on how the protocols are written, you may need to call medical control for direct orders, permission, to administer certain treatments to determine the transport destination of patients, or to be allowed to stop treatment and/or not transport a patient. In these cases, the radio or cellular phone provides a vital link between you and the expertise available through the base physician. To maintain this link 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, medical control must be readily available on the radio at the hospital or on a mobile or portable unit when you call. In most areas, medical control is provided by the physicians who work at the receiving hospital. However, many variations have developed across the country. For example, some EMS units receive medical direction from one hospital even though they are taking the patient to another hospital. In other areas, medical direction may come from a freestanding center or even from an individual physician. Regardless of your system's design, your link to medical control is vital to maintain the high quality of care your patient requires and deserves. Calling medical control. You can use the radio in your unit or a portable radio to call medical control. A cellular telephone can also be used. Regardless of the type of communication, you should use a channel that is relatively free of other radio traffic and interference and one that will be recorded. Medical command communications create medical legal requirements that such conversations should be recorded. There are a number of ways to control access on ambulance to hospital channels. In some EMS systems, the dispatcher monitors and assigns appropriate, clear medical control channels. Other EMS systems rely on special communications operations, such as centralized medical emergency dispatch or resource coordination centers, to monitor and allocate the medical control channels. Because of the large number of EMS calls to medical control, your radio report must be precise and well organized and must only contain important information. In addition, because you need specific directions on patient care, the information that you provide to medical control must be accurate. Remember, the physician on the other end bases his or her instructions on the information you provide. As discussed earlier, you should use proper medical terminology when giving your report. Never use codes when communicating with medical control unless you are directed by local protocol to do so. Most medical control systems handle many EMS agencies and will most likely not know your unit's special codes or signals. To ensure complete understanding, once you receive an order from medical control, such as an order for a medication or the denial of a request for a particular treatment, you must repeat the order back word for word and then receive confirmation. This helps to eliminate confusion and the possibility of poor patient care. Orders that are unclear or seem inappropriate or incorrect should be questioned. Do not blindly follow an order that does not make sense to you. The physician may have misunderstood or may have missed part of your report. In that case, he or she may not be able to respond appropriately to the patient's needs. The role of medical control will be discussed further in Chapter 11, Principles of Pharmacology. Information about special situations. Depending on your system's procedures, you may initiate communication with one or more hospitals to advise them of an extraordinary call or situation. For instance, a small rural hospital may be better able to respond to multiple victims of a highway crash if it is notified when the ambulance is first responding. At the other extreme, an entire hospital system must be notified of any disaster, such as a plane or train crash, as early as possible to enable activation of its staff call-in system. These special situations may also include hazardous materials situations, rescues in progress, MCIs, or any other situation that could require special preparation on the part of the hospital. In some areas, mutual aid frequencies may be designated in MCI so that responding agencies can communicate with one another on a common frequency. When notifying the hospitals of any special situations, keep the following in mind. The earlier the notification, the better. You should ask to speak to the charge nurse or physician in charge, as he or she is best able to mobilize the resources necessary to respond. Also, whenever possible, provide an estimate of the number of people who may be transported to the facility. Be sure to identify any conditions the patients may have that require special needs, such as burns or hazardous materials exposure, to assist the hospital in preparation. In many cases, hospital notification is part of a larger disaster or hazardous materials plan. Follow the plan for your system. Maintenance of radio equipment. Like all other EMS equipment, radio equipment must be serviced by properly trained and equipped personnel. Remember that the radio is your lifeline to other public safety agencies who function to protect you, as well as to medical control, and it must perform under emergency conditions. Radio equipment that is operating properly should be serviced at least once a year. Any equipment that is not working properly should be immediately removed from service and sent for repair. Outdated equipment should be removed from service as new equipment becomes available. When you are beginning your shift, it is typical to check the ambulance to ensure that it is ready to go. You cannot assume that the crew before you left the ambulance well-stocked and in operational readiness. The radio is also an important component that needs to be checked to ensure that it is operating correctly and using the correct frequency. Sometimes, radio equipment will stop working during a run. Your EMS system must have several backup plans and options for this scenario. The goal of a backup plan is to make sure you can maintain contact when the usual procedures do not work. There are quite a few options. The simplest backup plan relies on written standing orders. Standing orders are written documents that have been signed by the EMS system's medical director. These orders outline specific directions, permissions, and sometimes prohibitions regarding patient care. By their very nature, standing orders do not require direct communication with medical control. When properly followed, standing orders or formal protocols have the same authority and legal status as orders given over the radio. They exist to one extent or another in every EMS system and can be applied to all levels of EMS providers. Other backup plans can involve using a cell phone and calling the ED directly. The problem with this approach is that the conversation will probably not be recorded. Medical command conversations are often recorded for the purpose of quality improvement.